Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salieri Report. Today, we are joined by none other than Dr. Mark Skidmore. He has a new update to his missing money report. It's always a pleasure, Mark, to have you on the Salieri Report, and you have done some incredible work here. We're going to talk about it, but first, let me just say welcome.
Thanks, Catherine. I'm glad to be on again and talk with you, and it's always very interesting and enlightening.
So diving into the very bottom of the subterranean treasury market is always interesting. Okay, I just want to go back and recap from the beginning. Your first report in the missing money kind of rocked the world was September 28th, 2017. If you haven't visited our website, missingmoney.salieri.com, I would encourage you to do it. If you go there, there is on the navigation bar, the first item is 21 trillion missing. And what you'll find is a series of Dr. Skidmore's reports and updates along with the original documentation on the 21 trillion of undocumentable adjustments from fiscal 1998 to 2015, both for HUD and Department of Defense. Anyway, but if you go there, what you'll find is the original September 2017 report. We then did an update almost immediately in October. First of all, you kept finding more missing money. If you remember calling me and saying, oh my God, we found another trillion. But also the inspector generals did us the honor of taking down their documents to your to your surprise and amazement. So we had to note that. Then in December, I guess December was also the IGs took the things down. Then we got an update from one of the departments on the missing money, and they redacted all the information. So that was worthy of a comment. But the big new update came in September and then December of 2018 with the promulgation of the FASB Statement 56. So why don't maybe you talk and just tell folks what that is?
Sure. Sometimes we refer to it as FASB or FASAB. It's the Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board, which oversees and provides supposedly provides guidance to federal government accounting standards. And after all of the questions and information, they recommended and federal government implemented a new policy that basically said, we're going to reserve the right to modify all the financial statements available to the public in any way we like. There was no guidelines about the magnitude or the degree to which they agreed that they wouldn't even acknowledge or tell us that those funds had been or those reports had been modified. And so if you sort of believed in the system, you could say, oh, well, they're just doing it to preserve, you know, some of those very sensitive issues. They want to not reveal it. But if you're not, you know, buying in, what you see is this total change in the laws, which is unconstitutional because there's no guidelines. We already had a black budget, which we can't see what's in that really. So why do we need every single government entity and agency to potentially modify, change, move funds across areas, conceal? And there's no restriction as far as I can tell. I've read that Standard 56 numerous times, and there's just no limitations on the degree to which these reports can be modified.
It's quite amazing because first of all, you don't know who does it. So it's a secret group of people, can do whatever they want and keep it secret. And so when you're looking at the financial statements, you've no idea what they mean.
Yes, I was shortly after the DOD put out their audit, their very first ever external audit, I was talking with Matt Taibbi, a reporter on the phone. He said, well, what's your impression of the audit results? And I just said, well, they just passed Standard 56. They just told us that they're going to modify any financial statements in ways that they like. how can I possibly offer any kind of assessment? Why would I take any amount of time to look at the financial statements if
I just want to underscore, they issued this in time that they could use it before that first audit got issued.
Yes, that's right. Just about a month before those audit results. Right. So I don't even know what to say, you know, like, well, sure, the financial statements come out, but you don't even know if they modify, because it won't even tell you that this has been modified, and you don't know how much or where, you know, how things have shifted. I don't even know what to say, right? You can't say anything.
So if you the missing money site, we have a section where we do all the financial laws. And one of the things we go through with FASB 56 and the classification laws is this applies not only to the 21 covered agencies, but 150 other related agencies or entities of the U.S. government.
Yes, that's right.
And then through the classification laws, all the companies that, including publicly traded companies that do business with the federal government, so they can have secret books as well. So you're talking about you're basically talking about taking the U.S. securities market dark.
And what is amazing is that so few people are even talking about it.
You know, yes, it's just, but you and I are talking a blue streak and have been for 2 years now. Or 3 years now, because in September it will be 3 years. Another thing I want to point out before we leave FASB 56 is that this happened. This was approved by the General Accountability Office of Congress and the Office of Management and Budget at the White House. And it was done on the week that we were having the Kavanaugh sex war Congress. And so most Americans thought that the House and the Senate, Republicans and Democrats, were fighting, and they were all fighting with the White House. But in fact, the White House, the House, the Senate, both sides of the aisle got together and basically took the entire financials of the U.S. government dark, and with it, essentially, the U.S. securities market together.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, that's one thing that I've learned since the last financial crisis is there's always a distraction, it seems, when something really important is happening.
Right.
Our eyes are tempted to look elsewhere. And so the Kavanaugh hearings appeared to be that. We're worried about the activity of a man in his high school days.
Well, you know, it was Matt Taibbi who pointed out to me, I hadn't even focused on the fact that the Kavanaugh thing was happening when they adopted it. But it was funny because I went back and forth with Taibbi by email. I got really frustrated, and I said to him, wrote to him, and I said, what is it about secret money for secret armies that you don't understand? You know, I said at the time, and I keep saying it, I could have told Jeffrey Epstein the minute FASB passed, he was a dead man. Mm-hmm. Because what this means is they can launder everything through government accounts. They don't need all these complicated money laundering schemes. You know, Enron, Epstein, Clinton Foundation, you don't need them anymore. This is the low-cost solution.
Somehow they have to have enough people within the system to move this money around.
Right.
Right. And they have to say, well, okay, I guess that's the way it works.
Well, there are a couple pieces on the accounting standards advisory on FASB 56, if people are more interested, that are linked from the series of reports and updates. So let me keep going. Then you published a really fabulous article, Should We Care About Secrecy in Financial Reporting, where you talk about how important these issues are and why they're important. And then you decided, you had thought one of the reporters writing about this was going to do a FOIA. In fact, in the 2015, which was the last year we really have undocumentable adjustments for at the Department of Defense, at the Army, if you look at the $6.5 trillion of undocumentable adjustments, which was sort of the biggest number ever, there were 170 transactions that totaled, I think, $2 trillion.
$2.1 trillion, yeah.
Yeah. And what you said is, you know, that's not a lot of transactions. Why don't we dig into that? And you thought a reporter had FOIA'd it. They hadn't. And so you put in a FOIA, and then you, it took quite a while to get a response, and you got a response. And then you wrote the update this year in May 2020 on the FOIA response. But in the meantime, someone had encouraged you to take a look at the Treasury market, and you did. And what you noted in the May report was there are very unusual patterns of redemptions and rollovers that would make you think, you know, that the what we started the year, I think, with 21 trillion or 22 trillion outstanding, now it's 26 trillion. You know, the redemptions indicate that they're carrying a float that's much bigger than 26 trillion. And of course, issuing treasuries off balance sheet, of course, would be one great way to finance 21 trillion. Because the big question has always been, you know, Catherine has always said the 21 trillion is real money, and the Department of Defense is, or HUD has always said, oh, well, it's just accounting. You know, those are just accounting confusions, and it's not real money. The question is, if you have massive securities fraud, which we've seen in the mortgage market, but we also have in the treasury market, then it's another indication we're talking about real money. So now, this week, we're just going to publish a new August 2020 update. And this one's pretty amazing. I mean, the last one was pretty amazing, but this one really rocks your world. So why don't we just dive in? Tell us about this new update.
Sure. You know, as you were kind of going through the chronology, you said that I wrote, "Do we care about secrecy and financial reporting?" But that was really a joint effort between the two of us. I want to acknowledge that.
Right. But you did more work than me. So I want to acknowledge that.
Well, okay. Fair enough. contributions on your side to some key insights. So I don't want to not acknowledge that.
Okay.
And then similarly, when we did the update just a few months ago, yeah, there were 170 transactions, which we have reviewed and talked about, but they're just enormous. You know, if you keep in mind that in that fiscal year, the Army's general fund budget was $122 billion. You know, the $6.5 trillion in unsupported adjustments is just incomprehensible.
Right.
And so, but within that report, there were 170 transactions, adjustments that tallied to $2.1 trillion, which is, you know, about as big as the Canadian economy. It's just an enormous itself, right?
Right?
And it's just 170 transactions.
Right.
So, you know, I just wanted to ask, well, what could those have possibly been for? And we did get some information, and folks can go on your website and look at the detail there. We won't cover that again. But along the way, Tom Stannis, a lawyer here in Michigan, had contacted me and said, hey, you should really look, you know, maybe on not just the uses side, but on the sources side, because if there's a lot of money, you know, being spent, maybe it would show up in treasuries. And he noted the very high redemptions and reissuance. And we talked about this in our last interview where, you know, you have government debt with different time periods of maturity. Some of it is short term, some of it is longer term. And so when you're perpetually running deficits, by definition, when Catherine's bond comes due, the government gives Catherine her money back with interest. But in order to do that, it has to reissue another bond to Mark. And then it takes the money that I give them and gives it to you. And so this is the redemption reissuance churn that has to occur. And so what we did in the last update was just talk about the churn, the turnover that would be required to manage $22 trillion in debt at the time for 2018-19. And we weren't getting $95 trillion in redemptions that were needed, right? And
right.
So we had clear data on the external debt, but there's about $6 trillion of debt that is held internally, the largest chunk of which is the Social Security Trust Fund, about $3
trillion. So let's step back and just talk about internal, what internal means. So the government has different pots of money. So the Social Security Trust Fund, people through their payroll, they pay their Social Security contribution, and then that money is invested in treasuries. And the government's managing the Social Security Trust Fund, and the Treasury is issuing the treasuries, but that's an internal booking. Even though it's a trust fund, it's the government on both sides shifting money back and forth between to a government account and a government managed trust fund. There are many of these different pools and pots that end up managing, you know, investing their money in treasuries. And so you get a significant amount of internal transactions.
Yeah, and it's all non-marketable debt. It happens within the government itself, and it essentially owes money to itself on behalf of Social Security contributors, which is all of us, right? And so the idea of the Social Security Trust Fund is that there was more money flowing in for many years in Social Security taxes than were being paid out. And so that money went into the fund. And right. Now we're approaching the transition point where that money is going to be drawn down, because we have more and more people qualifying for Social Security as, you know, as society ages. And we have fewer workers per retiree. So that would be the biggest of that $6 trillion. The Social Security Trust Fund is the biggest one at about $3 trillion. But there are a number of other very large funds as well, and a whole bunch of small funds that Treasury manages on behalf of the government and the system. You know, after we published that report and talked about it, I did an interview with Greg Hunter on USA Watchdog, and I just suggested that, you know, sort of collective intelligence was really a useful thing, so that if people had ideas on what might be happening with all these redemptions, we'd be open to it. And I did get some help and some ideas. And so we went back to the Treasury website, and on the Treasury Direct website, you actually have access to daily transactions in each fund that Treasury manages, including the Social Security Trust Fund, including a whole bunch of different funds. And you can actually see on each day what the balance was. And David Pear, who's a software engineer, contacted me and said, hey, why don't I write some Python code and we can just systematically take a look at all these funds and see what's going on with each of them, which is really helpful, because if you go on the website, you can only do one fund one day at a time. It's really right. Hard to get, you know, kind of a big picture view on it. And so I really want to acknowledge David Pear. Also, Rob Kirby had some real insights as well. So you'll see when the report comes out that they're acknowledged on the report, as well as Tom Stannis, and just thanking him again for asking these questions and bringing it to our attention. So when we started looking more systematically at all the 700 funds, there was one fund called the Thrift Savings Fund, which is kind of like a 401k for federal government employees, where they can make contributions. The government matches at some rate, and the fund goes in, and then it's managed on behalf of federal government employees and retirees. And the total fund balance right now is about $560 billion. So it's a very large retirement fund. And part of the fund is managed by BlackRock. About half, 50 to 55% of the fund is composed of different types of index funds that are managed by BlackRock. And then there's a government account series fund that's managed solely by Treasury. And this was the big red flag for us. We found something interesting, because about half, almost half of the total amount of funds in the Thrift Savings Fund is in the G Fund, the government account fund. It's managed Treasury, by BlackRock, right? And that fund is composed 100% of one-day maturity securities. So
I want to stop you for just a second, because, and we've gone over this several times with John Titus on Money and Markets, and we'll continue to do so. But one of the reasons this is so important is BlackRock has basically used itself as a platform for a couple of retired central bankers, including the Stanley Fischer, former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, former chairman of the Israeli Central Bank. But a group of central bankers designed a plan approved by the central bankers, the G7 central bankers at Jackson Hole, called Going Direct, which then appointed BlackRock to manage whole aspects of the Going Direct global reset, I'll just call it. And so you have a group of central bankers sitting at BlackRock who are running major portfolios for the Federal Reserve right now. Now, they're also running these accounts for the Thrift Savings Plan. At the same time, the G Fund, which is part, but is not supposedly managed by BlackRock, but by Treasury, is having all the unusual patterns you're about to describe. And yeah, the closeness of this money to the pots that the Fed is running, and some of those pots are joint with Treasury. So you've got Treasury with big pots of money, the Fed with big pots of money, BlackRock managing big pots of money for both Treasury and the Fed. You know, and this is beginning to look mighty flexible and mighty close.
Well, thanks for that overall big picture view, because this is just one piece of all of that.
Right.
But a really important and interesting piece, I think. So what this means is that about $250 billion is churned every day. So at every period, the government redeems to itself $250 billion, and the next day it reissues over and over and over again. So that, you know, usually if it's like a long-term bond, like a, let's say a 10-year note or something, on average, you know, a 10-year note would need to be churned once every 10 years, right? So 10% right, of the amount in there in any given year on average would need to be churned. This needs to be churned every single day, every single working day. So this fund alone is responsible for $40 to $50 trillion of that redemption and reissuance that we were talking about last time.
Right.
And so what we've done in this report is presented all of the daily transactions and aggregate them by year, and then calculated the turnover and churn that is required. It's very interesting that this is a one-day fund. Like, what in the world is that for? Now, I do want to say that it looks like our government is making the, you know, regardless of this as being a one-day fund, it's required to offer an interest rate of, at, you know, of the average of treasuries in the marketplace of 4 years or greater.
Right. So it's paying a four-year rate on a one-night paper.
Yeah, it's paying a four-year rate on a one-night paper.
Right.
The employees and retirees are being made whole. But the question is why are they holding it in one-day treasuries? And so when you look at all of the transactions dating back to 2001, that's all that's available on the website, there are these periods in which the fund balance at Treasury drops dramatically, in some cases down to zero. And it can be very low for months at a time.
Well, it's very interesting. If you look at the pattern, it's very much the pattern of aggregate the money, pay out a big dividend. Aggregate the money, pay out a big dividend. Now, I'm not saying that's what's going on, but there's definitely a pattern to it. And it makes you wonder, you know, clearly this fund, it looks to me like it's being used for multiple purposes. And, you know, it's not just playing the game of the G fund where you stockpile and invest people's retirement money.
BlackRock is known for its passive investment strategy. This is a point that Rob Kirby made.
Right.
And so you would expect, you know, indexed funds and the funds not to be up and down and shifting around like you might see in an active fund. And in fact, some of these drops, they go all the way down to zero.
Right.
So the G fund goes from, you know, 200 and some billion down to zero or a very low amount for weeks or months at a time. Usually the zero balances don't last, you know, more
but
than a day
it
or
it looks
two.
Like they're paying the interest, the four-year interest on the balance that should be there as opposed to what's there.
I think so.
Right.
I think so. So I, you know, we just started asking questions. Well, why, first of all, why is it all held exclusively in one-day securities? And second of all, why is there such variability? If this is a fund managed on behalf of retirees and future retirees, do the retirees even know that this money is being funneled in and funneled out? And we don't, right now, we don't know where that money goes, you know, in the interim period when the fund balance drops so dramatically. So we're talking about, you know, in the later periods, literally, you know, $200 billion just sort of going somewhere, according to these reports. And so that begs the question, is this even real, right? I mean, is this really what's going on, or is it just a cover?
So it's very common for somebody who served in the federal government or still serves in the federal government to have money in the G fund. And I am highly confident that at least one person listening to this is going to have money in the G fund. And if you have money in the G fund, you have the ability to print off this report and send it and say, what is going on with my money?
Yeah, I somehow, you know, if you look at the actual Thrift Savings Fund financial statements, and the last 10 years are available on the link that you'll have access to here, you know, in the report, you can see the balance in each of the funds, including the G fund, on December 31st of each year, the last day of the year. And that amount typically, well, will match the amount on the last day in the Treasury data as well, you know, on the fund in the Treasury website. So they tend to match each other. Well, except for 2017, on the last day of the year in 2017, the balance that Treasury had in its fund was quite low, you know, like in the tens of billions rather than 200 billion. And then the financial statement says that the G fund had 200 billion or so. So it there is, you know, usually they match. They tend to put all that money back in by the last day of the fiscal year, and then they report that in the financial statements. Except for 2017, there seems to be a discrepancy. So I think it's worth, you know, if you have funds, you would want to know. But I suspect that government employees and retirees don't know about the variability in the G fund, what they're doing.
I'm sure they don't know. I'm sure they do, because I've looked at G funds on behalf of one or more clients, and I'm sure they have no idea. I had no idea.
No, how could we? So it's interesting that all of this is reported in Treasury. It's interesting that they have, it's composed exclusively of one-day notes that are churned every day. It's interesting that that yields $40 to $50 trillion every year in turnover. And that accounts for the largest chunk of the churn that we were talking about last time. There are some other funds as well that have one-day securities, but there are 700, accounts or funds that Treasury manages, and it's difficult to get a handle on all of them, right?
Right.
So I think we need to really look carefully at all of the funds that have one-day notes. And sometimes with money's flowing in and flowing out, it might make sense to have these one-day notes, you know, so that it can facilitate the transactions into and out of, say, you know, another retirement fund or you know, money's flowing in and flowing out. But it should only be a small fraction, not...
So here's my speculation. As you know, when I just finished State of Our Currencies, and one of the most valuable pieces of building and holding a reserve currency position is to have what I call a financial bazooka. And a financial bazooka is the ability, with great speed and great power, to enter into the markets and command and drive a position with greater financial strength than anybody else on the planet. And I have to say, if you could turn the 6 trillion interagency accounts into a flexible pot of money you could use for the financial bazooka, you know, and do it secretly, that would make you very powerful.
Yeah, if you know, One of the things I did was look at I tried to identify funds that I thought would have large balances, like the Social Security Trust Fund or the Medicare Fund, et cetera. And I was able to account for 4 or 5 trillion of the 6 trillion. And I could, you know, spot check in the funds. And most of those funds, you know, like the Social Security Trust Fund, it's not composed of these one-day securities. Right. It's just some. Right. And there are a couple in DOD, a retirement fund and some sort of health fund that have fairly substantial amounts. But the real big one is this thrift savings fund. But we're talking about, you know, by the end of the period, you know, $250 billion that is sloshing around in and out of the G fund.
I wanted to bring up why this is so important. And that is, you know, as I've said, I've always believed that the $21 trillion was real money, although it could be much smaller or much greater because you could be laundering money. You know, you could be selling oil in Iraq and laundering the proceeds in. And so $10 trillion could be revenues and $10 trillion could be, you know, those revenues going out the back door. But one of the reasons I believe they're real money is I had so many different experiences that indicated to me that the mortgage securities fraud at the Department of Housing and Urban Development and related at Fannie and Freddie was of an extraordinary magnitude. And anytime I tried to explain to people the magnitude of the mortgage securities fraud, they couldn't fathom it. And then the bailout we proceeded to have in the financial crisis, 24 to 29 trillion of transactions at a time when, according to the reports I read, 8 trillion would have paid off all the single-family mortgages in the country. So whatever was going on, it wasn't a housing crisis, it was something else. And, you know, and it was funny because then I still had people who couldn't fathom the extent of the mortgage securities fraud. And then the servicing fraud happened in 2012. And when people began to understand the extent of the servicing fraud, that's when they started to realize, well, the mortgage securities fraud could be that great. And the reality is, to do that kind of mortgage fraud, you had to have the Treasury, the Fed, the New York Fed, the New York Fed member banks, the Department of Justice, and HUD do it together. And once you have that mechanism in place where they're doing Treasury or they're doing mortgage securities fraud to that extent, why wouldn't you also do Treasuries? There were two stories that really brought it up for me. One was when HUD first produced their first financial statements. I'd been part of a group of people who got the laws passed that required them all to produce the financial statements that started to generate the undocumentable adjustments. And what happened was a mortgage banker approached me with massive files trying to persuade me that the amount of mortgage securities of FHA insurance and related securitized mortgages in the market were many multiples of what they showed on the balance sheet. And at the time, I thought he was crazy because what he was saying was that the Treasury, the New York Fed, the Fed and Department of Justice and HUD and the New York Fed member banks were engaged in massive mortgage securities. I just couldn't fathom it at that point. The second thing that happened was after I started to investigate the mortgage securities fraud when I was litigating, a researcher from London approached me with a series of documents on private placements that he claimed had been issued to Meyer Lansky to soak up the drug money. And the Treasury's, you know, this is a private series that wasn't registered on the financial statements. And I went through the documents, and the authorizing official was a guy I used to work with at Dillon Reed, who had always, it seemed to me, had some kind of secret leverage on the chairman of the firm, Nick Brady. And I took one look at the documents and I just started to laugh. And I said to the researcher from London, I'll bet you a dollar this is real. But it would make sense that they would be soaking up all the, you know, they would be issuing treasuries off balance sheet to soak up all the money and the narcotics trafficking and other illegal cash flows. Anyway, so I'd seen some indication of funny business in the Treasury markets, but I cannot believe you'd have the extent of the mortgage securities fraud and have set up the mechanism to do it, and you wouldn't have treasury fraud. One other thing I mentioned to you just before we started, and I want to mention again, I got in a bit of a squabble at a conference in 2005 as part of the GATA group, you know, talking about the missing money, and was shouted down and said it wasn't really true. And then right after that, the Financial Times had an article about foreigners saying that the U.S. owed them $2.3 trillion more than was shown on the accounts of the U.S. I'll never forget Bill Murphy sending out an email saying, okay, everybody owes Fitz an apology. The Financial Times says she's right. But I looked at that number when the Financial Times wrote it, and I realized, you know, that has to be the treasury market. That can't just be mortgage securities. It has to involve treasuries. Now, that's a guess. It's not proof.
Yeah. I mean, we're all left to speculate to some degree. Right. We're looking through this faded, you know, this unclear, it's very opaque, and we're trying to make sense of it. One of the things that I've noted over the past few years is, you know, we've focused a lot on DOD and the unsupported adjustments there. And so a lot, whatever happened to bubble up in the mainstream media really focused on the quote unquote waste and fraud that occurs in the DOD, but not very many people will say, hey, if there's a lot of money flowing in or inappropriateness happening in DOD, the money comes from Treasury. And so there's this linkage and systematic. And so a lot of times, you know, I'm not saying within the circles that we're speaking with here directly, but a lot of people sort of have this idea, this branding that the federal government's bonding system is rock solid and that straight up. And so the problem is with DOD, but that can't be, right? It has to be integrated.
Right.
And I think that's what you're saying about, you know, HUD and the mortgage security market, et cetera. You can't get this stuff done without some sort of coordinated effort.
Right.
And I that's a really important point. It's like, well, what is going on here? It's not just the DOD, you know, shenanigans. It's got to be a coordinated action, I think.
Absolutely. If you look at how these accounts are run, it's really a matrix structure that, well, the New York Fed is the depository, but the execution of most of that function is through the New York member banks. And then in coordination with Treasury and the different agencies, and the Department of Justice is thick in it. So none of those things can happen unless they're working together to make it happen. And by watching how they did it at HUD, I'm confident they can do it at DOD. Now, I never worked at DOD, so I can't talk about DOD with the confidence that I can at HUD. But, you know, it was quite interesting to me when the FASB went around, you know, through the sort of regulatory process to get comments from all the different agencies. It was so interesting to see HUD come back and say, oh yeah, this is great, we need this. And the question is, why would a domestic housing agency need the ability to classify portions of its books? And then the SEC came back with essentially no comment.
Yeah.
And here you have an action being taken that will take essentially, in my opinion, the US securities market dark. And the SEC has no comment. I mean, what? It's quite, you know, the reverberation of this is quite astonishing.
Well, one of the things we discussed in the Do We Care About Secrecy report was this, you know, it's not just on the government side that the, you know, opacity is increasing with Standard 56, but that years ago, I think it's the NSA can exempt some key companies from reporting their financial statements accurately, you know, if it's a matter of national security.
It's so the National Intelligence Director.
Yeah.
So National Director of Intelligence can do it.
That's right. So we do have sort of a double blind there,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
There are some companies that we just can't know what their true balance sheet is and what their financial
statement right, which means if I take $21 trillion from the U.S. government and move it into private hands, I can't see it on either side.
And we don't know which companies are exempt.
Right. Right. It's quite extraordinary. You know, we've had a change of government by accounting
edict.
Edict. Yeah, it's not even a regulation. There's a law, there's the Constitution, then there's a law, there's a regulation. This even doesn't rise to the level of a regulation. This is an edict. So we've just changed the entire Constitution, all the laws, and all the regulations by an obscure accounting edict.
Well, so coming back around to the Thrift Savings Fund, I don't know how this works. I don't know if it's connected to the accounting adjustments, unsupported accounting adjustments at the DOD or at HUD. I do know that it is really contrary to the stated passment investment strategy that is stated by the Thrift Savings Fund. Nearly half of its portfolio in a fund that churns over every single day. And it's very unusual for a passively managed fund to have dramatic variation from day to day, week to week, month to month in terms of its.
Well, the one thing I could say that's dangerous for the G Fund retirees is if you did have the US government declare bankruptcy or some kind of radical rechange, and that fund that minute was at zero, you know, they could be in real trouble.
That's possible.
Right. One of the things I wanted to say that because I think you've done an amazing job with these looks at the treasury market is, you know, I love the expression, no one is as smart as all of us. And it's clear this is a topic which is, you know, it's just a bear of a thing. You look at it and you say, what is going on? I have no idea. But by circulating it around and getting Rob involved and being responsive to people who call and then getting on Greg and inviting other people to comment, I think we've really been able to steadily accumulate more intelligence the more eyeballs we have look at this. And that's why I would ask everybody listening to this, if you know anybody who's significantly involved in the fixed income markets or the treasury markets, or is at the rating agencies, or is a beneficiary of the G Fund, or who would be interested, let's share this and see if we can't collect some more intelligence.
Absolutely right, Catherine. I think each of us may have some pieces to offer, and collectively we can learn more about what's going on. And it's not to say that we haven't been trying to do that. We do have some people that have worked with or for Treasury that, you know, we've approached, and we're trying to get more information, you know. But having said that, sometimes it doesn't trickle in very quickly.
Right.
And we don't, not always responsive.
Well, to me, I think the thing I keep first and foremost in my mind is wherever that $21 trillion went, it belongs to the American people. And it can be gotten back, or the assets can be gotten back, or the ownership interests can be gotten back. And I think in the political process, it's very important to put that money on the table and say, well, wait a minute, don't tell me there's no money. You know, where's the $21 trillion? So I think these accounts matter. And I think there's a real opportunity if we keep following the thread.
Also, I think that there are a number of people who haven't quite made the jump from the manufactured reality to something that's more in the realm of real reality. And, you know, and it's hard for us all to make sense of, you know, sort of that mapping of what's real and what's not. But I think that if we can shed some light on this and ask questions and try to increase the transparency, that might, you know, help people say, wait, there's something wrong here.
Right. And
we need to collectively address it. And the more people who are in that role, number one, it helps them, right? It helps them kind of come into a greater knowledge and a place that's healthier personally, but also the more people who are aware and can ask insightful questions, that's power.
Right. There's real power in this. I was going to, when we published the commentary of this, I was going to put up Maria's song again on the missing money, because her song really reminds you how much power there is in knowing this, understanding and using it. It's very interesting when I go back, when I try and explain to someone my version of the last 20 years as opposed to the official reality, this really helps me document, because we're working with government numbers. We're working with government, published government numbers. And it gives me the ability to ground an alternative view of what's happened and prove that the official reality can't be true because the numbers don't match. And I think the numbers help you get back to a more coherent view of what's happened that makes a lot more sense, because if you try and buy the official reality, you end up in a state of incoherence because it doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And that's a very disturbing once you kind of make that transition, but you come to a healthier place, I think. But that's, you know, I think one of my big goals is to help people create a mapping from something they think is, you know, real, it's in the official reality, but it doesn't quite make sense, right? And if you can use some linkage to something they can anchor on, you know, like a government report, and show that this doesn't make sense, it gives them, you know, some stepping stones to getting to a place that they're, you know, in a better place and understanding what's going on.
So I was just saying to you earlier that if our average income in the United States is $65,000, if we do a global reset and we have to unwind the China trade, you know, that could go to 10 or 15. And you were saying, well, that's an 80% drop. I was thinking, you know, it'd be more like a 40% drop. And I said, well, but that's if it's shared evenly. If the people running the global reset decide to husband everything for themselves and drop the general population much more, could end up in 80%. And I think knowing about the missing money and being able to use it at the bargaining table helps make sure that whatever that reallocation is, it's a much fairer one.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And it's, you know, I think you've done such a great job of, again, mapping out the scenarios that may emerge here in the not too distant future with your work on the state of the currencies and linking things together, and even the whole question about the pandemic and the shutdown and then the subsequent ramping up, quantitative easing, expansion of the deficits by trillions of dollars, and then thinking about what are the implications of all of this as we move forward, because the other shoe hasn't dropped yet. And
so I would say one of the things that most angers me is when I hear the reason for inequality is new technology, because I think, no, the reason for inequality is the manipulation of the federal credit, whether through the missing money or quantitative easing or the bailouts. Yeah, and that is the primary source of inequality.
It is.
Right.
And I've attended Federal Reserve kinds of events where we, you know, sort of talk about inequality and improving rural condition, you know, rural community quality of life and concerns about, and, you know, we, in those events, there's not much talked about that. This fact that we've really juiced the system that benefits a relatively few number of people who are on the very upper end of the income and wealth distribution, and that is a key cause of the of all of this, the veneer, and then there's the reality.
Right. So any other comments? Because you've gone through quite a journey, and every time you do another one of these things, I get this sense that I used to get, you know, you would call and say, oh my God, we found another trillion. And I have this image of you following on the string. And when you saw what was happening in the G fund, it was kind of like, gulp. So tell us a little bit about Mark's great journey.
Yeah, sure. I just increasingly, I think, open to seeing the world in a different way. Every churn, you know, in the bend offers a new view and a new perspective. And just as one example, I get a lot of, you know, messages from people when I do an interview or talk about these issues. And sometimes it can be really useful, sometimes not as useful. Mm-hmm. But in this one case, Tom Stannis here in Michigan sent me a note and just brought to our attention this question about the very large number of redemptions.
Yeah.
You know, he probably has talked to a number of professors and others along the way, and they kind, you know, or an accountant, and they kind of look at it and say, yeah, that's really unusual, but there must be some explanation for it. And then they sort of dismiss it. And I think one of the things that I've, you know, learned is that, you know, that's sort of a glitch in the matrix. And it's like, well, maybe it is something you should dismiss, but not necessarily, right?
So my point is, it's important to remember, we pay government, and under the law, government is obligated to give us full disclosure.
Absolutely.
That's under the Constitution. And so if I don't understand the finances, it's because government is failing to do what it is required to do. I mean, there is no reason why you can't get a financial statement for your county or your state or the country that is understandable and digestible for you. I'll never forget when you asked me to look at the HUD financials, and I went in, and when the reporter was writing the article, so I read 3 years of the HUD financials and the FHA financials, and I couldn't stop laughing, because if you look at how much experience I have with the HUD and FHA financials, and how much experience I have with mortgage and housing, and how much experience I have with accounting and economics, they make it almost impossible even for me. And there's no need. It could all be totally understandable to a layman.
It's possible to share information in a coherent way.
Right.
And right. I guess in summary, I would say that I've just learned to be flexible, and not, if it doesn't fit in with what I think the world is, it doesn't mean that I should dismiss it. You should be open, right?
Right.
And explore and ask questions and seek understanding. And in this case, I think we'll learn more here in the coming weeks and months about the Thrift Savings Fund.
Oh, I think so.
It's quite astounding that it's $250 billion and is in one-day securities, and it churns every day. And there's tremendous variability. And it's like, this is not consistent with the passive investment strategy of the Thrift Savings Fund.
So my prediction is, if when you do an interview with Greg Hunter on this, at least 1,000, you'll get anywhere from 70 to 100,000 views. At least 1,000 of those people will be beneficiaries of the G Fund, and they're going to email it to some others.
Yeah.
And it'll be great. I also wanted to bring up, I know I sent this to you, so I know you know about it, but the rating agencies have been very afraid to comment on the federal debt since the Department of Justice went after Standard & Poor's and basically got the president fired and got the holding company almost bankrupt as a result of downgrading the federal credit. So since then, the rating agencies have been surprisingly quiet.
I wonder why.
But Fitch just came out with a report saying, you know, ringing the bell on the escalating amount of the federal debt. So between the unwinding the China trade and now Fitch saying that, I think the pressure is on.
I think the pressure will be on. I suspect we'll sort of continue the way we have through the election, but sometime after the election, something's gonna give.
And right.
I'm a lot concerned about what the world will look like once we have that other shoe drop.
Well, I would say this, whatever the world looks like, it'll look a lot better to us if we're economically grounded and resilient personally.
Yes.
Right.
That's the other thing. I've increasingly made adjustments to our own personal lives, try to become more resilient. You know, I saw after the last financial crisis what mess we are in. And so you can take this information, use it, and then make decisions that hopefully improve your resiliency.
Now, I just want to say, in September, assuming they don't pull the rug out from under us, you and your wonderful wife and John Titus are going to be together at Lake Geneva for an event there. And Titus is working on a whole major presentation. You know, we've got Darlene on the phone with the resort, with the resort audiovisual people. So this one's going to be good. And I want John to film it so we can put it up on Soleri and put it up on Best Evidence. But anyway, so you and John are going to be available and are going to be there to meet. So if you want to come to Lake Geneva, check it out on the website. You can meet Dr. Mark Skidmore and John Titus together. It's kind of an earth-shattering concept, and I'm sort of irritated I can't be there.
Kate and I are really looking forward to the event, and I've just really appreciated John's work, and so I'm looking forward to meeting him in person and also learning from all of his work. He's just dug into, you know, really at a foundational level, all of the years of the Federal Reserve. This is very valuable service to society. So
absolutely. He's a great guy, as are you. So, Dr. Mark Skidmore, I can't thank you enough for this report. And again, everyone go to missingmoney.com. There'll be a commentary on the homepage. You can find it through that or the commentary for this Soleri report. And I just want to thank you again. You've done an incredible service. Keep following that thread, okay?
Yeah, and thank you, Catherine, for all of your work. Really valuable for us all. Thank you.